The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. Beginning today with Yahoo Life. Butter moms are having a moment. French moms were there first. Whole ingredients, full fat, no snacks. Butter moms are finding common ground with how the French feed their kids. By Jessica Roy. When my daughter was born in January 2025, I found myself engaged with a part of the internet I had previously only glimpsed in passing. Overnight, it seemed, my TikTok For You page was flooded with day in my life videos, showing mothers across the world filming their daily routines, changing diapers, washing bottles, rocking screaming babies. I'd never been much interested in vlogging-type content, but now I found them strangely comforting to watch. They confirmed how similar we new mothers were in our exhaustion, in the mundanity of the everyday, and in how small our lives had become in the newborn bubble. But there was a side of that parenting-focused internet that was less comforting. If anything, it seemed to only stoke all the anxieties inherent to being a new mother. This was the part that trained a moral lens on every parenting-related choice, casting judgment on other moms for the kinds of diapers they bought, whether they sleep-trained or co-slept. And this part of the internet made something that should be so simple, feeding your child, seem like an impossible, Herculean task, one that, if you got it wrong, meant that not only would your child suffer, but also that you were a bad mom. Just a few of the numerous considerations parents must make when it comes to feeding. Breastfeed, formula feed, or combo feed. Exclusively breastfeeding or pumping. When do you introduce solids? Purees or baby-led weaning? Protein-heavy or vegetable-forward? Sugar or no sugar? Dairy or soy? Snacks or no snacks? The list goes on. And while the internet has no doubt been an incredibly helpful resource for answering this questions, it's also a fount of constantly shifting, often conflicting advice that can leave new parents more confused than when they began. Parents are constantly hearing that there's only one right way to feed a baby or a child. If you don't do baby-led weaning, your child will become picky. If you do baby-led weaning, then they won't. You're told to pressure kids to eat, and also never pressure them. It's confusing. Jennifer Anderson, a dietitian and the author of Feed Them Well, said in a recent Substack interview, "Couple that with the government's recently shifting guidance on nutrition, including a crackdown on the artificial food dyes lurking in a lot of kid-oriented treats, and it's no surprise that some parents are making a conscious effort to remove all the noise and return to a simpler way of feeding. TikTok's recent Butter Mom trend is perhaps the best example of this. The 90s coded aesthetic archetype rejects diet culture and moralistic judgments around good and bad foods. There's no hand-wringing over going full fat, as long as everything is eaten in moderation, and instead embraces a return to comforting, nourishing meals cooked with whole ingredients. It's a direct response to the almond mom who glorifies diet culture, obsessively counts calories, and prizes sugar-free and low-fat over the alternatives. When food content creator Madison Vitale had her first baby late last year, she immediately began thinking about how she could translate her love of food into healthy, delicious meals for her son. "I'm obsessed with food, and I want to be giving my kid the best, and not like anything processed or kind of junk. I just feel like I eat good, so he should eat good, I guess," she tells Yahoo. For Vitale, who identifies as a butter mom, that means shopping organic, cooking whole foods, and loading up on full fat, butter, and dairy. "Because I'm in the food space, I'm around all kinds of food all the time, whether it's fatty foods, tons of sugar, cookies, sweets, things like that," she says. "And I just live a life with everything in moderation. And so I'm showing him that, like, yeah, we're active, we move our bodies, but we also enjoy. We don't restrict things." The butter mom approach to eating may be a somewhat new trend in the U.S., but eating full fat, whole ingredient foods in moderation and without restriction is just the way things are done in other countries, like France, where my daughter was born. In the U.S., 3 out of 5 parents make separate meals for their children. But in Paris, where I live with my French husband and daughter, kids eat everything the parents eat. My daughter, now 15 months, loves lobster and scallops, soft, salty cheeses, mushrooms roasted in olive oil and thyme, and the crunchy knob end of a baguette. I realize this sounds obnoxious, but it happened without me even trying, at her nanny share, which she attends 5 days a week. Her French assistante maternelle has been feeding her fresh fish, seasonal vegetables, and homemade fruit compotes since she was 7 months old. In fact, the meals French kids receive at daycare and at school are so healthy, so gourmet, they're practically legendary. When the late chef and journalist Anthony Bourdain visited an elementary school cafeteria in Lyon in 2014, he observed, "The kids attack their food like hungry trencher men, wiping out 3 servings in the time it takes me to eat one," before declaring of the butternut velouté, "This is good." Kimberly Blanchot, a Parisian publicist, and mother of 5-year-old Amelia, agrees that schools in France have healthier offerings. They might seem less exciting to kids, but the menus are quite varied throughout the week and pay closer attention to balancing the key nutrients, protein, vegetables, and carbs, she says. Amelia is at an age where she's picky and doesn't eat as many vegetables as she used to, but I still try to get her to taste new things regularly and make sure she has a balanced diet, Blanchot adds. Part of the reason French schools offer such well-balanced lunches is that food is truly key to the culture, as important a subject to learn as math or history. France has a very strong food culture, in the sense that there's specific moments where you eat specific things, and it's really part of the culture. And I feel like that doesn't really exist in the U.S., says Isabel Bertolami, an American dietitian and mother to 2 French-American kids who lives in Aix-en-Provence. When she lived in the U.S., Bertolami says she'd frequently hit up places like Whole Foods for the healthy versions of snack foods. She loved brands like Halo Top for low-calorie ice cream or protein-packed popcorn. But after moving to France, all that changed. I'm in a totally different food space since moving here, just simply because I realized, coming here, it's sort of just like back to basics, she says. Of course, there's probably just as much processed food as you could get in the U.S., but the fact that there's such a culture around going to your local market, knowing your butcher, knowing your fruits and vegetable person, and you kind of form these relationships, that's been a big change for me. And while there's been a push in the U.S., to teach kids about intuitive eating, in recent years, the practice of listening to your body and following your hunger cues, that style of eating has long been the norm in France. In one 2021 study on the portion sizes French parents feed their preschool-aged children, researchers found that determining portion sizes is an intuitive action that depends on habits and mainly arises from experiences with feeding their child and his or her appetitive traits, and that most parents do not search for information or recommendations to guide their practices. France raises intuitive eaters, Bertolami says. From such a young age, they expose them to so many tastes and flavors and food. So they start off with a really good base. But at the same time, no one's ever really restricting things from them. For many French children, there's a strict schedule throughout the day that dictates when you're supposed to eat. Breakfast, lunch, goûter, around 4 p.m., a snack, typically something sweet, like Nutella on a piece of baguette, and dinner. This schedule keeps kids from snacking all day and means they're actually hungry at mealtimes. By contrast, in the U.S., a recent study found that snacking makes up about 27% of American children's daily caloric intake, and there's been a substantial increase in snacking over the last few decades. It's shocking when I go back to the States and I'm with my friends and all their kids, and it's just like snacks. They're everywhere, right? And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is crazy, says Bertolami. Taking cues from the French has long been a favorite pastime of American parents. In 2012, Pamela Druckerman published Bringing Up Bébé. One American Mother Discovers the Wisdom of French Parenting. And it quickly hit the New York Times bestseller list. In the book, Druckerman, an American writer living with her family in Paris, interviews French families to gain insight into what American parents can learn from them. To many French moms, the revelations gleaned may seem rather obvious. Teaching patience and self-control around food. Allowing kids the space to learn independence and self-soothing. But for some American fans of the book, it's changed how they parent. The book taught me to relax at meals, at restaurants, and to expose my little kids to fancy foods, even if they're not accustomed to it, a TikTok mom named Bethany Ellen posted recently, calling the book life-changing. Of course, it's much easier to encourage healthy eating habits in children in France, a country where everything from the healthcare system to the parental leave system is set up to support families, and where organic and healthy foods are much more affordable. Even though I'm a freelance writer, the French healthcare system paid for my 3-month maternity leave, and once I went back to work, it helped subsidize child care. And don't even ask about how inexpensive it was to give birth. When families receive so much support from the state, it frees them up to have more time, money, and energy to focus on living a healthier life. And in large cities like Paris, there's no such thing as a food desert. Markets and grocery stores are practically on every corner. I do feel like in the U.S., motherhood just isn't as balanced because it's harder to have child care. Everything feels a lot harder, says Bertolami. With so much government support, it's easy to see why France treats feeding children less as a problem to solve and more as a structure to inherit. And why, despite the shift toward a butter mom lifestyle that might be a lot more difficult to do for parents in the U.S., but that won't stop American moms like Vitale from trying. Butter has gotten such a bad rap of, oh, it's bad for you. But honestly, it's something that I enjoy. It makes me happy. And I just don't want my son to be shying away from anything, Vitale says. I want to have a house that's full of home-cooked food. Not like, you know, a cabinet full of random snacks. From The Strategist. Thanks. It's a Wiglet, by Krista Bennett DeMeo. When Margaret Josephs of Bravo's The Real Housewives of New Jersey showed up at makeup artist Erica Taylor's book launch party with a sleek platinum bob, senior editor Crystal Martin and I immediately took note. I love your hair, Martin told her. Thanks. It's actually a wiglet. Josephs, who has just been announced to the cast of Amazon's Reality Retreat, replied, "Martin and I locked eyes. We had to know more." What's a wiglet, you ask? Sometimes called a topper, it's not a full wig, not extensions, but one of those partial hair pieces that makes hair look fuller and more finished without anyone noticing. After the party, I reached out to Josephs for more information on her wiglet. Not only has she been wearing it for years, but she's a big fan of hair pieces in general. "They're life-changing," she says. "They make doing my hair so easy. I look put together, and it takes me like 5 minutes." Meet Kiki. Kiki is the name of Joseph's wiglet. Yes, she has a name. I wasn't surprised to learn this. I find most women name their wigs and hair pieces as if they're an alter ego. "She's 6 years old," she says. "I take very good care of my hair." The topper, made from human hair, was sourced by her hairstylist, Julius Michael, from a now-defunct company called Hidden Crown. The piece originally came long, reaching the middle of Joseph's back. Michael cut it to work in a blunt bob and colored it to match Joseph's platinum blonde hair color. Why wiglets are suddenly everywhere? Joseph's and her wiglet are part of a growing trend of women wearing hair pieces. According to Grand View Research, a data analyst firm, the global wigs and extensions market was valued at over $15 billion in 2025 and is expected to reach $31.13 billion by 2033. The firm speculates that some of their popularity may be fueled by thinning hair, with up to 50% of women experiencing hair loss or some thinning at some point in their life. For Joseph's, the biggest appeal is how easy the wiglet makes getting ready. Her natural hair is currently more of a shagged bob, but the topper lets her switch into a sleeker shape whenever she wants. "It's the little bob from White Lotus that became very popular," she says, "but I've had it for a long time, and I love it. Plus, it saves her real hair from damage." "Hair extensions can ruin your hair," she says. "They're very high maintenance." Putting the wiglet into place is simple. "You keep your bangs out and the front of your hair," she says, "and literally just pop it on your head." For maintenance, she takes it to her hairstylist for washes, with purple shampoo to keep the blonde color cool, and styling. He blows it out and flat irons it. Kiki travels in style, on a mannequin head wrapped in an Hermes silk scarf, inside Joseph's carry-on luggage. "I think people in hotels think I'm insane because she's sitting out on the bureau," she says. Because it's real hair, Joseph's can style it at home, like she does her actual hair. She just avoids loading it up with hairspray or other styling products, so she can go longer in between washes. "I can go 2 months before washing," she says. "It's not from your scalp, so it doesn't get dirty in the same way your hair does. Beyond the wiglet. Joseph also plays around with other pieces, mostly her clip-in bun, a synthetic hairpiece that takes less than 5 minutes to put in place. I just pull my hair back in a ponytail and wrap the bun over it. She loves that it gives her a polished look in minutes. In the past, Joseph's has worn a long ponytail, too, but she says she is ready to retire the look. My husband says I look like an aging stripper, she jokes. The wiglet, however, gives her a sophisticated look, and no one would suspect it's not her natural hair. From the Boston Globe. Why are all the men around me doing all the talking? By Judy Kugel. In the senior, ages 62 and up, community where I live, about two-thirds of the roughly 180 residents are female. But I've noticed that when I, and usually another woman, join men for meals in the dining room, the men talk about 90% of the time. And most of them don't ask anything about us females. I am sure that approximately zero male residents know what I've done with my life, and they don't seem to be curious enough to ask. My feeling is that these men probably held leadership positions before retiring, and they miss being in charge. Taking command of conversations remains their modus operandi. Although those of us born between 1928 and 1945 are often called the silent generation because we are said to be conformist, quiet, and not rebellious, we women do have plenty to say. But most of us women of a certain age don't call men out for dominating conversations in mixed groups. My independent living facility isn't the only place where men do this. One of my middle-aged sons reports that his generation was taught that men tend to cut women off and that they should give them more time to speak. But I believe the jury is still out on the success rate of that recommendation. When I raised this topic with one male resident of my community, he told me that at a recent dinner, in a group of four women and two men, the women did participate. But he agreed that in general, men tend to dominate conversations. His explanation was that women tend to ask questions, and most men do not. Therefore, he said, men talk more. Shortly thereafter, I had dinner with him and another man and two women, and the men talked probably 90% of the time. I refrained from calling him out for it in the moment, but when I confronted him later, he reminded me that we women indeed asked a lot of questions. Alas, he was right. A male friend of mine, who is in his 90s and still teaching, is perhaps the best male listener I have ever encountered. He suggests that I ask new male acquaintances a different kind of question from the ones I have offered up before. He suggests something like, "What are two or three things that tell me the most about you?" He thinks that could possibly elicit a similar question in return. I plan to give it a try. From allure. Extreme thinness is the opposite of longevity, by Valerie Monroe. Even if you don't keep a sharp eye on the current celebrity coverage, you've most likely noticed some remarkable photos cutting into your feed in recent months. Remarkable in their featuring of razor-sharp shoulder blades, protruding collarbones, olive oil arms, even visible ribs. There's a vast shrinking going on among the famous names that have a substantial impact on our beauty standards. Some of our most visible celebrities have gone from merely thin to gravely gaunt. I doubt this is the first story you've read about the phenomenon, calling out how troubling it is to see. In an interview this spring about The Devil Wears Prada 2, even Meryl Streep remarked on what she saw at recent fashion shows. I was struck by how not only beautiful and young everyone seems to me, but alarmingly thin the models were. I thought that had all been addressed years ago. Annie Hathaway clocked it too, and she made a beeline to the producers about it, securing promises that the models in the show that we were putting together for our film would not be so skeletal. I've never been interested in critiquing anyone's body, and especially the bodies of women in the public eye, who've been historically criticized and condemned for their shape and size. In fact, I believe those kinds of observations are destructive and often malevolent. But after much internal debate, and debate with my editor, I felt I had to address the part of this conversation that, for me, is just too troubling to ignore. Many of the gaunt are famous women over 50, even over 60. You're probably aware that extreme thinness is a concerning health issue for girls and young women. But for those of us in midlife and well beyond, it can be truly disastrous. Some of our most visible celebrities have gone from merely thin to gravely gaunt. On a recent random scroll through Instagram traffic, I slammed to a sudden stop at a video clip of Demi Moore at an event several weeks ago, looking frighteningly skeletal. I sat for a moment, stunned by the image, before I noticed the lead comment, honking something like, "Demi Moore, aging like a fine wine." First, women are not wine, or donuts, or strawberries, as we are often referred to in marketing of all kinds, but especially beauty marketing. And though I understand the metaphor about improving with age, this one sours pretty quickly when you consider that even a fine wine at some point will turn to vinegar. In general, the point at which a woman is no longer perceived as reproductively viable. Moore, at 63, presents as a much younger woman. I suppose this is what precipitated the comment, suggesting that she is aging well. But aging well is not about looking younger. It's about being healthy and consequently looking healthy. And there seems to be some confusion about that. The ramifications of an unhealthily low body mass index, or BMI, as a rule under 18.5, are legion and unpleasant, especially if you'd prefer not to die early. It's associated with an increased risk of mortality, one that's significantly more than in a woman with what's considered with a normal BMI. It's also associated with an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease and dementia. That's the really bad news. The run-of-the-mill bad news is that underweight women often suffer from reduced muscle mass, sarcopenia, which older people in general are prone to, and low bone density, another perimenopause, menopause pitfall best avoided, as it increases the risk of fractures. Might you be concerned about your aging skin? Excessively thin women are prone to chronic skin fragility and skin tears, dermatoporosis. And that's in addition to the normal age-related increased skin fragility that often results in bruising. And while we're on the topic of skin, you might have noticed that faces, even the faces of young women, when they're extremely thin, emphasize characteristics caused by age, among them sunken eyes and cheeks. The point is that women in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond, if we want to age well, need to be aiming for the opposite of the image that Moore and many of her Hollywood peers present. We need to be thinking about ways to increase physical strength, focusing on healthy nutrition, building bone density and muscle mass, and maintaining both physical and mental agility. In our later 70s and 80s, there may come a time when we experience unintended weight loss and consequential frailty that could limit our movement. All the more reason to keep our bodies as robust as possible while we can. That's why I find it so disturbing to hold up ultra-thin celebrities as an ideal of aging. Studies have indicated that eating disorders among women over 50 have increased. The stresses, physical and emotional, of perimenopause, hormonal changes, weight gain, mood swings, can increase a woman's vulnerability to disordered eating. Not to mention life changes, such as kids leaving home, caring for aging parents, recalibrating the sufficiency or insufficiencies of a marriage among shifting responsibilities. Then there are the unrealistic cultural beauty ideals. One study reports, with the increased weight gain predictable in menopausal women and the increased socio-cultural pressures promoting an ever thinner and more youthful ideal, many women engage in extreme behaviors to delay the natural signs of aging. Another study noted that over 50% of women of normal weight report increased body dissatisfaction and more discontent with their bodies in their 50s as compared with their younger years. Normal weight was considered the CDC's guidelines of a BMI between 18.5 and 24.9. All of this, of course, makes sense. The further we get from the cultural beauty ideal, youthful, ever more slender, hypersexualized, the more vulnerable we are to a desire to control or modify our appearance. When the options for modification and control increase, thank you, Ozempic, what we see is, for example, a Hollywood awards ceremony featuring a score of actresses who might give new meaning to the term human frailty. There are many reasons a person might find herself struggling to maintain a healthy weight, including illness, psychological or physical. Several years ago, there were discussions, not all of them kind, around the actor Chadwick Boseman's diminished physique, when none of us knew he was fighting cancer. The Princess of Wales' shrinking silhouette was also reported on before she revealed her own diagnosis. Moore recounts in her autobiography that she struggled with eating disorders and other addictions, even while establishing a career ablaze with remarkable performances. It's impossible not to recognize her courage and grit and resilience, and to feel compassion for her. I can imagine there are many people who might call me out, or call me something else, for commenting on the bodies of public figures or suggesting that these celebrities are damaging influences. Women tearing down other women. Leave them alone. And they would be right in saying that I don't know what's going on in the real lives of Demi Moore or Nicole Kidman or Michelle Yeoh, or Cynthia Erivo, or any of the other women whose frail frames have concerned me in recent months. But as the frailty seems to be spreading, it's clear in my mind that this is a trend, not a health epidemic. And in highlighting the trend, one that is objectively alarming, it's not my intention to tear anyone down. But I believe celebrities, when they consistently make the choice to stand in the public eye, have a responsibility to lead by example. If any of them were my sister, I wouldn't be among those fans applauding and idolizing them, or among the stylists dressing their bodies in designs that highlight for the cameras knife-edged clavicles and shoulder blades. I would be trying to help them be responsible to themselves so that they could be responsible to those millions of women who quite rightly admire them. From the New York Times, My Obsession. The artist Lauren Halsey's Thousands of Black Figurines by Nicole Archimpong. Lauren Halsey, 39, is known for her Afrofuturist immersive installations, sculptures, and mixed media works. They variously allude to ancient Egypt, funk music, and the storefronts and signage of South Central Los Angeles, where she was born and raised and is still based. This March, she opened a public sculpture park with a garden in the neighborhood. decorative porcelain black figurines, the kind that her mother and grandmother would display in their homes, are another of her touchstones. She sources them primarily around South Central, though once she and a friend drove 2 hours north of the city to buy boxes of figurines from a couple who turned out to be white. It was quite awkward, Halsey says. The couple didn't expect my friend and me to be black, which is shocking, and I didn't expect them to look like they did. We were all dumbfounded. Over the past 20 years, she's accumulated around 2,000 of these mass-produced statuettes, which typically depict black people performing everyday activities like sitting in a rocking chair. She started incorporating them into her work when taking architecture classes at El Camino College in Torrance, California, and again while earning an MFA at the Yale School of Art's sculpture program, though lately she mostly reserves them for her personal collection, which also includes other types of mass-produced statuary. They make me feel good, and they conjure, depending on the figurine, a very specific memory, she says. It feels like my life, and so many folks' lives, articulated in a form. The collection. Most of the figurines in the collection are black folks in church, playing the tambourine, at the piano, in a choir. But I have all sorts of them, like someone reading a book, or a kid playing in a tree, or a woman working out, with dramatized aerobics or calisthenics. Or they'll depict a dice or card game, or black women laughing in the kitchen. Number of pieces in the collection? More than 2,000. First purchase. I went to a local discount store off Crenshaw and Manchester in 2006 with my grandmother. The store's no longer there. I don't know where they were importing the figurines from, but I just bought them up. One was a very stylized DJ, and then there was another version of the same character skiing. He's not wearing ski clothes. He has on this yellow and red Letterman jacket, silver bottoms, and funky glasses, and he's staring into space. Latest acquisition. A friend gave me a box of figurines in different church scenes. I have so many church scenes, I could set up a megachurch congregation. Most expensive. They're always around the same price, maybe $5 or $7. I've even gotten them for 99 cents. I've never spent more than $10 on one. They're the most humble objects and are always at the discount store or even in the corner of somebody's liquor store. Has one ever broken? Yes, 100 have. The heads pop off. Someone drops them. I drop them. It's devastating, but I usually repurpose those in my work. Most precious. There's this iconic Annie Lee painting of an exhausted black woman sitting on a bed. You've probably seen it. Blue Monday, 1982. I have 11 figurines depicting that painting. I see myself and so many women around me in that one image. It motivates me to get up and not sit in my weariness. From Down East, Dream Weaver, a new Mainer rediscovers a traditional Rwandan art form. and she hopes it will change lives in her home country. In 2017, after winning a U.S. visa lottery, Angie Mohokaye was waiting for a departure flight at Rwanda's Kigali International Airport when her mother gave her a bundle of sweetgrass and sisal and a message, "Do not forget our culture." Angie, who now lives in Gorham, Maine, had learned to weave those natural materials into intricate baskets from her mother and grandmother while growing up in Burundi and Rwanda. She had not, however, made a basket in years. "I thought weaving was boring," she says with a smile, as she prepared to move to the U.S. with her 5-year-old daughter. Acquiring weaving supplies was low on her list of priorities. "I took it to make her happy," she remembers. Now Angie's mother, who has since joined her in Maine, gets the last laugh, as she weaves constantly these days, making elaborately patterned baskets, bowls, placemats, and coasters that she sells at craft fairs, art galleries, and exhibitions across the state and online. It all started just a few months after she arrived in Maine and was waiting to hear back from potential employers and child care providers. Those weaving supplies began to look like an enticing way to fill the hours. Her first piece was an agaseke, or peace basket, with a black zigzag on a field of white and a tall pyramidal lid, a symbol of a plentiful harvest. Peace baskets got their modern nickname in the wake of the 1994 genocide that tore the country apart. By the time she finished the basket, she had found a job as a housekeeper in Portland, and she gifted it to a co-worker. Impressed by her craftsmanship, her co-worker's mother asked for a basket too, and offered to pay. So Angie kept weaving, working in both traditional geometric motifs and the multicolored organic designs that Rwandan basket makers have adopted in recent years. She often sketches new styles on paper before beginning the painstaking process of wrapping strong, durable strands of sisal around dry sweetgrass and carefully coiling and stitching it into bowls and baskets. Before long, she realized there was a market for her work and that sales could help raise funds for her dream project, supporting the rural women and children she had met years earlier while working in medical research in Rwanda. They were living impossible lives, she says. On the couch in her home, she tears up. "I saw them suffering and hungry, and I started to think how I could give back." Today, Angie works the overnight shift at a group home for people with developmental disabilities, but she considers basket making a second full-time job. She hires women in Rwanda to harvest and ship sweetgrass and sisal to her, and she uses half of the profits from her basket sales to fund poverty relief efforts. In the central city of Muhanaga, she has rented out a house where women can take weaving lessons, make soap they can sell, or practice reading with a tutor. Angie is currently figuring out how to expand her business, Agaseke, and turn it into a nonprofit. Her mother now also makes baskets for the business. Eventually, she hopes to build a big enough market that she can import finished baskets from Rwanda, paying the women who make them much more than they receive for providing the raw materials. If the women there can start weaving and send their baskets to the U.S. market, she says, that can change their life. From Costco Connection, frozen pizza perfected. Five ways to elevate your frozen pizza, by Paige Triola. On days when you want dinner ready quickly, it's a relief knowing that a frozen pizza is waiting at home and takes less than 20 minutes to bake. Cheese pizza is great all by itself. Adding just a few simple, fresh ingredients can make it an even more delicious and substantial meal. Whether you're looking for more protein, some spicy heat, or extra Italian flavors, here are five ways to kick this dinnertime staple up a notch. Extra seasoning. Start by sprinkling about a half teaspoon of garlic powder and onion powder on top of the frozen pizza. Measure out half a tablespoon of dried Italian seasoning blend, then crush it to a fine powder between your hands, sprinkling evenly over the cheese. Bake according to package instructions and enjoy the extra flavor. Summer garden. Lay plump tomatoes and fresh spinach or basil leaves over the frozen pizza, only covering the cheese, not the crust, then bake. If using basil leaves, add after baking. The result is a margarita-style pizza bursting with garden flavors. Buffalo chicken. Chop some rotisserie chicken into 1-inch pieces and toss them with a splash of hot sauce. Spread the chicken pieces generously over the frozen pizza, then bake for a spicy, protein-packed meal. Prosciutto, mushrooms, and Parmesan. Before baking, top your frozen pizza with sliced mushrooms. Finish with a hefty sprinkle of grated Parmesan cheese and pop it in the oven. Then top with prosciutto before cutting. Italian sausage. Sauté Italian sausage in a pan with a bit of olive oil. Then finely chop the fully cooked sausage and layer it over your pizza before popping it in the oven. The juicy bits of sausage will get slightly crisped and add a savory crunch to each cheesy slice. There are plenty of other creative and delicious ways you can level up your pizza. Let these ideas inspire you to make your own tasty recipe. Buon appetito! And that brings us to the end of the program. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. And please join me again for the Women's Hour.
Did you know ADA paratransit riders in Worcester, Auburn, Boylston, Leicester, Northboro, Oxford, Westboro, and West Boylston now have the option to schedule trips through the Worcester Regional Transit Authority's new online reservation system? Call customer service at 508-791-9782 or email paratransit@therta.com to begin scheduling your trip online.
Hello, listeners. Would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.